Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mystic Records Radio. I'm so glad you tuned in, and it's a beautiful day. Welcome to this segment of Party or Go Home. We have a special guest in the studio here, Johnny V of the band Social Spit. Hello, Johnny.
What's going on, man?
Well, you know, we're coming into 2019 and have a lot of good things going on. We've been working with Social Spit on the Return to Slimy Valley, and you've got some new songs in the works, and well, you know, our listeners out there are curious about Social Spit. Would you like to tell us a little bit about the band?
Well, that's a long story. Sure, you want to hear it?
Of course,
you know,
we
I can go on and on. Okay, well, Social Spit started off as a new wave cover band in the late 70s by a couple of guys, Bruce Hammerly and I believe David Fleminger. You know, there were just these musicians that, you know, they're still around. They're pretty damn good musicians, but eventually they turned it into a punk rock band with this kid named Bruce quote unquote Scabs Atwell. So, like, they got it together, and they did a show at the Blind Center on Yuba Street. Excuse me.
Is that in San Diego?
I just smoked a cigar. So I'm, in San Diego. I just smoked a cigar, so my throat's all messed up. Excuse me. Like, that went over, like, fairly well. Like, I heard a recording of it, and it sounded pretty, you know, mostly it was just a bunch of, like, Sex Pistols covers and stuff, but they had a couple of originals that were good. You know, I liked what I heard, but then, like, I was at this show at the North Park Lions Club. It might have been Black Flag. They did a few shows in 79, 80, you know, 80. They did a show in 80 where I believe there was no sound system, so Des Cadena, he was singing out of that big monstrous amp that Greg Ginn built, you know, and it sounded horrid, but you know, it was scary. They scared me. They literally frightened me. And I met this kid, Bruce. He's outside, and he's wearing an armband with a questionable logo on it, and a black leather cap from the same World War II establishment.
I see. Yeah, I get it. Yeah.
Yeah, he scared me, but he was. I mean, because I was in there. I was a hippie wearing an Adidas T-shirt and tennis shoes, and I had, like, long hair, and he was one of the only people that came up to talk to me, and I'm all, well, I want to know what's going on here, like, why, you know, why is this a thing? And he told me about punk rock and what it meant to him, and some of the music, so I met him at the same place a couple months later, and I had some recordings I did at my house, and one of the songs was a song called Pissed Youth Riot, which is one of the first punk rock songs I ever wrote, one of the first songs I ever wrote, and then there was another song called Rumors of War. And I played those for Bruce, and he was nodding his head and tapping his foot, and he liked it. And so he asked me, because, you know, like, they were going to do Social Spit, and they didn't really have a guitar player. So I practiced with them a couple of times. Back then, it was like this drummer named Brian Watkins, a bass player named Scott or Scooter, and his brother, trying to remember names here, but he was in a band later on called Dream Theater or something. He was a pretty good guitar player. I can't remember his name, but we got together, like got through some songs. You tried to write some new ones, but nothing ever became of that. So later, there was this other band called Violation 5, and that was Peter Verbuge, who was one of the boys club, and the bass player Russ Weber, who was renting the studio down in Chula Vista, National City, Sweetwater Studios. And so they just offered, why don't you guys just, move into the studio? So we got Brian on drums, Russ on bass, me on guitar, and scabs. So we played some covers, and then we just started writing songs. There was songs like what was that? Broken Arm Army or something like that. I don't remember. That became Reagan Gun Club. Kids from Nowhere, which this kid named Dooley, James Orr, Dooley Orr, he used to come down and mess with us sometimes. We would have some of the guys that eventually, played with Battalion of Saints or the Neutrons. They would come in and make noise with us. This kid.
And you guys are all from San Diego.
Yeah. This guy Donnie Diaz, who was a really good guitar player and bass player, had a Marshall amp. He dragged that down there. And back then, I was playing out of this old Lab Series L5, which it didn't sound. It sounded good enough, but so we recorded a few practices, and we were at Mad Mark Rude's one afternoon, and we asked him, "You want to hear what we've been doing?" And so we play him this tape, and on the basis of that tape, he's all, "Man, that kicks ass! Okay, you guys are on the show on
December."
Nice.
He was a great guy too.
Yeah, so he puts us on this show. So we do the show, everybody.
And what was the name of the band
me.
At that time? Was that your first Social Spit show?
Yeah, that was Social. That was the first Social Spit show I did with
nice.
Social Spit.
Nice.
And that was Scabs was on singing, and we opened up for I believe right after us Social Distortion played, and then the Adolescents
nice.
Played, and it was a real good show. Down the line, it was supposed to be Giza X and the Monty Man, but
I
they canceled.
That.
So the
yeah.
Adolescents. This was at the North Park Lions Club, and it was great, but most of the San Diego kids that were there, they didn't like us because I played too many lead guitar solos. I'm all, well, what's Battalion of Saints been doing? What's Chris Smith been doing? Eating chopped liver? Every show he would just go off on wild, crazy. I mean, much more than I ever did. And he was the hero, and they were like the band of the times. You Social Spit, like hippies play, lead solos in the middle of songs. I'm like, what? So, we played a few more shows. We didn't. Because Bruce, he just decided he wanted to quit. He didn't want to do it. And there was this one guy that loved us. He let us play at a party at his house. And then we played at another party out in Balboa Park. And that guy was Cliff Cunningham.
Cliffy.
And I never considered that he was anything but a fan. But I just asked him, well, do you want to do it? Do you want to? He's all, hell yeah. So we start practicing, and he immediately start coming up with all of these songs, like Eat Shit and Die, Well, actually, that wasn't, you know, we had that one before, but, you know, he gave words to Reagan Gun Club, you know, that were relevant for the times. And,
sure.
And so, we, you know, we played like there was this one place in San Diego off of Highway 8 that had a huge Batgirl, like, on top of the roof. And I forget the name of the place, but, you know, Battalion of Saints played there when they were still the Neutrons and the Big play. We did a couple of shows there, and then there was this joint called the Zebra Club, and we did a few shows there. And, you know, we kept on going until the summer of 81, and I was working at this print shop over by the airport, and, you know, like, they fired me because they wanted me to work full-time, and I was going to school and at Grossmont College, and I didn't want to work full-time, so they fired me. So,
well, that stinks.
And then in the meantime, I had this girlfriend that, you know, we were all planning on moving up to San Francisco, and then we had this huge breakup thing, and then I decided last minute, there was this guy named Dan Reilly, who used to be in the first punk rock band in San Diego was called the Scoings, and they had this song called I got the record even, I can't remember, but they actually, you know, they had this one song called Doctor's Wives, and they had another song on the other side, but he was on that project, and so he said, move up to San Francisco and do a band. So I drove him back up to San Francisco, and I moved into his closet. And so I started doing music with all these San Francisco people, like Naomi Ruth, who used to be in Dan Hicks, Naomi Eisenberg, Naomi Weiss. You know, she's on Facebook. You know, I did some stuff with her. There was a band called Alienation that was very popular with the what would be called today the LGBTQ crowd. And,
right, Daniel De Leon, I'm trying to think of the name of the band. He had a female lead singer. They were very popular in the San Francisco scene. The San Francisco punk scene was really jumping then.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, like from the first day that I moved up there, I walked down the street. From Church Street, like I was on Castro and Church, and I walked down into the Mission District, and there was this, and I just happened to have, you know, like a whole bunch of cashier's checks in my pocket. You know, I dumped all my money into them. I walked down there. There's this, there was this guy like, on a side street, Valencia, selling wristbands. You know, like the spikes, you know, and it was Rob Noxious from a band called The Fuck Ups, and he was very excited about it.
Oh, I remember them. Yeah. You just recently
invited
told me one
me
of their cool songs.
Right, he invited me to their practice, and so I'm like, oh, cool. So I was planning on going there anyway. So then I walked on down to Mission, and I walk into this old, beat-up hawk shop, and there they had this, Marantz Super Scope portable, you know, full portable stereo recorder, you know, professional recorder for like $60. I'm all, what? I mean, these are like $500. So I bought it. it even had a working battery, so I charged it up, and I walked on down to Iguana practice studios where they were playing, and they, you know, like introduced themselves, and they were playing these cool songs, and I hooked up you know, a microphone, you know, I hooked up the sound system into my recorder, and that's when I made that tape, and they played all these great songs, and they used it to get some more shows. So from that point on, you know, I was in the San Francisco culture. So
sure.
I was in a new wave band called Umbrella Defense with Paulette Reed Denis, who used to be in Fade to Black, and Dan Reilly was the bass player. He was in a band called Party of Five later, But and then like well the most famous person was our drummer Gil Ray, who was in Game Theory. So, you know, we played a bunch of great shows until that, and then I was asked to start this punk rock kids, you know, to play music about kids by Tim Yohannan of Maximum Rock and Roll. So we started Juvenile Justice, and that was me, Ron Juan, or like Ron Charles, and this kid Chris Savino, and he had great words, and we just played all. All of our songs were like less than a minute long. We had dozens of them, and we had like a couple of different. You know, our first drummer was I can't remember like what band he came from, but eventually Gil Ray from Umbrella Defense joined us. So we did a bunch of shows with him, you know, including you know shows with Minor Threat, Battalion of Saints over at Berkeley Square. You know, played at on Broadway a bunch of times. Valencia, one night we played at Valencia Tool and Die, and then there was this guy named Mike Manifesto, who wanted to, you know, he really wanted us to play at this show. I didn't really support his politics, but he was a nice guy, so he actually paid us gas money to drive down to San Jose after our Valencia Tool and Die show. So we hauled ass down there as quick as we could. And we'd get down there at like a little before, and they're closing it up. So we all went to some Denny's and had dinner, and it was great. But so I was in that band for a while, and then I started my own band called Dangerous Visions, and that was just me and this drummer named John Norwood, you know, who was awesome, and this guy named Scott Spencer, and it was just three piece. And you know, we got to open for guys like Helios Creed. You know, I loved him, and we really got along well because he also used PV amps, and I liked PV amps. So, I got into financial trouble, so eventually I had to move back down to San Diego in 1985, and so Cliff was always talking about, well, let's do a Social Spit reunion. Because we had done one reunion in 1983. I drove down from San Francisco, and we came. We went and played at a show at the Kings Road, which Peter Rebruge, he ran that club, and Mark Rude was down there, and we did our set, and we do Warhead at the, and then he sings it. I mean, he gets on the mic and sings it with us, you know, like a. Mark Rude does that. I mean, he's all, let's have a Social Spit reunion every year. I'm all, well, hell yeah. So when I got back down, we started immediately talking about doing it. So it took us another year to, because we had to find new players because those guys were gone. Brian was gone, and I didn't know where Russ was. So we got this, there was a band called Prowler who used to always open up for the Mentors. So we got Paul Scumdog to play drums, and we had this kid from Diet Tribe, Sean, and we did like about a year's worth of shows with those guys, and then we replaced Sean with I was going to this church, and everybody goes, church, but you know, it was just like I was going there, I was playing music with these guys, and there was a guy named Mike Von Gietzen who had this Steinberger stick bass. I mean, he was a good bass player. So he's the guy that's on our first record, a Psycho Award. You know, Mike's playing on that, and he would just plug in and play. You know, like he never said anything about it. You know, he liked doing it, but eventually he had to quit because he needed to go back to Montana. And so like at that time we had a major shift. We replaced our drummer with the guy that we have now, Javier Vega, who was he was 18 at the time, played in Jesus bands down here. You know, he was really. And then Dave Nestor was, you know, owned some studios out in El Cajon, so you don't have to rent a practice place; we can just play down here. So we just we added these guys. And at one point we had a second guitar player, John Chandler, and he did two shows with us, and he was, you know, he was good, but he had like a weird guitar sound because he had this weird little crate amp, and I was playing out of this Marshall, and it was, I don't know why. I mean, we liked him. He had the right attitude, but I mean, at the time I was going through this hubris that other guitar players got it. I mean, I shouldn't have, we should have kept him, but that's just band politics, and it was something I didn't need to do. But we ended up with Javier and Dave, and so that changed our sound considerably, because if you listen to the first EP and then compare it to the album is a lot more metal sounding, and that's kind of away from where I wanted to go with the sound of the music. So, I mean, yeah, even after we recorded the album, we tried to get back to the original sound, and we changed things back to the way that we used to play them. And we played up until 91 or so off and on. Then there was another version of Social Spit. It was Chris Roth from the Revolt Chicks. She's the singer, but she was a drummer first. She played drums, and we had this Rudy, our hippie bass player, and then me and Cliff, and we did some shows in 93, and then Cliff got married and moved up to Ramona, and I didn't see him for like another like 4 or 5 years.
Wow.
And finally, out of the blue, he contacts us. We start practicing down at Nestor's studio, and we played a couple of shows, at the Spirit Club that we used to play at. It was now called Brick by Brick, so we did a big couple of shows down there, and there was this one time we were practicing, and Dave Nestor was just kind of like, sometimes he would noodle, he would pick up his bass and start, we would be trying to figure out something, and then Cliff got upset, and he has his books full of Social Spit lyrics. He just slammed them on the ground and then walked out of the studio without picking those up. He wouldn't return calls. And so that was it until about 2005. I met a kid online on MySpace called Dan Scum, and on the basis of his looks, I contacted him and said, and I asked him, "Do you want to play drums for Social Spit?" And he's all, "Hell yeah!" And then I asked Cliff, and Cliff is all, "Okay." And then Dan is all, "Well, I've got my buddy Lenny Bly. He wants to do it too." So we did a bunch of great shows that year. But it was difficult because I had to drive Dan everywhere. I even had to buy him food, otherwise he wouldn't practice. we were supposed to play one show at Scolari's office, and then Cliff couldn't do it, so he told us, "Well, just do the show without me." And I mean, I would have done it, but Lenny just didn't want to do it. And in retrospect, he was right, because we shouldn't do a show without Cliff, because Cliff is the one that knows how to talk. I don't know how to talk. You can tell from my speech right now, I'm not good. I'm not good at talking to people, but Cliff is great. And we can't do it. And he's the singer, and it's his voice. For a while, he would sing some songs and I would sing some songs, and we would sing some songs together, and that was always really cool when we did songs together. But after 2005, I decided, well, no, it's got to be Cliff. I'm not going to sing any more of the songs, and I'll do background vocals, not as much, but because it has to be all him, because it's got to be, And when you have a lead singer, that's what they got to do. So, you know, otherwise
well, he's
they're
very
just
articulate.
Standing on the But you know, otherwise, he's standing on the stage twiddling his thumbs, and we know we can't have that. You know, we don't even do any instrumentals. You know, so
there
was another little bit of hiatus, but in 2009, you know, Cliff contacts us. Me and by that time it was me, Cliff, and Lenny, and Javier. I don't know where he had gotten to. We hadn't played with him for about 8 years, so. We had this guy, Jimmy Flynn, who used to be in Eminence, and there's another band that's more popular than that, but I don't remember the name. I can't remember it. It's like things go out of my head. Mike got a great memory, but it's bad. So, you know, we had him, you know like we started doing shows starting at the beginning of 2010. You know, we played at the Skybox up in Claremont, and then somebody was there and invited us to play at the Mercury Room immediately with some other, and so we hauled ass down there and we played down there too. So that was when I knew. That's when I knew it was more than just you know we've been at it ever since. And then about 6 months later, you know, there was problems, you know, scheduling rehearsals. Because Jimmy, you know, he never knew when he was going to be called upon because he was a driver. He had to drive people around in this limousine. And sometimes, like, they would call on him during practice. So he quit. And that's when we contacted Javier, and he was game.
He's a good drummer, too.
That was summer of 2010, and a lot of things have happened, you know, between then and now. Now we're going on our 39th anniversary, and that's what this show at the, you know, I just thought it was another show, you know, because it's always fun to play at the Tower Bar. But,
right.
Oh,
and,
yeah, that's our it's the 39th
people,
anniversary of when Cliff joined. That's what it is.
Right. And for people down in the San Diego area or who are interested in seeing the Social Spit anniversary show, it's going to be Saturday or Sunday, January 27th, and get there early about 5 o'clock in the evening, and
oh,
you won't be sorry.
It's going to start at about 2 o'clock. Yeah, you can get down there about, you know, 2 o'clock if you want to see all the bands, and there's some great bands.
Oh, it's starting at 2. Oh, wow, I didn't know.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Nice
and early.
I mean, I was told 5 o'clock, and I was assuming that's when we were going to go on, but the show starts much earlier, and there's going to be food and stuff, so, you know.
Oh, yeah, free nachos.
I think it's free. Yeah, I think it's free, but, you know, it might not be, but it's worth it, but. But yeah, there's the Yucks are gonna be playing, and Dennis Quicks, he's renamed his band again, and you know, like, the name goes out of my head. It used to be called Filner Headlock, and I just gotten used to, okay, Filner Headlock, that's a band, you know, and then all of a sudden he changes, so I forget what he called. I'm sorry. But,
no big deal. But it'll really be a good show. And for those who are interested, Social Spit is actually number 3 on Reverb Nation in the punk charts right now.
That's for the San Diego region, but you know, that's good enough. I'll take it.
There you go. Yeah. San Diego's a fun place to visit, and I hope people can get on down and see your show at the Tower Bar. It'd be really
nice
fun.
To visit, but you wouldn't want to live here.
Well, it's a lot warmer than Northern California.
I'd rather live in, you know, when I lived in San Francisco, I got to wear my leather jacket all year around.
There you go. And
down
I bet
here,
you played Gilman.
I
bet you played Gilman, didn't you, huh? 924 Gilman Street in Berkeley? course you did.
No, I've been there.
Really?
I played all over the place up there, but you know, that was the one place, you know, because back then there was Barrington Hall, there was Keystone Berkeley, there was Berkeley Square. We played Keystone Berkeley a couple of times with Umbrella Defense. Never played the Stone in San Francisco. That it was across the street from the On Broadway. Spent more time in the On Broadway. You know, I was at the very last show they had there with the Kennedys. You know, it was madness. It was sheer madness. But I mean, I've been to so many cool things. I was there one night, and Allen Ginsberg, the beat poet, was there with. There was another beat poet. Can't remember. They were throwing things at this other guy, but whenever Ginsberg would open his mouth, it was like, this is God speaking. And I can't remember the guy's name, but, you know, it's like, but, like the very next day I'm walking down Columbus with my dad and my girlfriend, and there was this saloon with old fashioned Western saloon doors, and this body, it comes barreling out, you know, ejected by the, and it was this guy. It was this beat poet, and I introduced him to my father. And he's like, "Oh, by the way, this is so and so the fan." Shoot, I just wish I could remember the guy's name. Like, I mean, you recognize the name if I remembered it. But I was on the spot like this. Like, I can't remember anything.
No, it's okay. But well, you know, back in 79, speaking of the dead Kennedys, Jello Biafra ran for mayor back in 79.
I remember that.
He actually got 4% of the vote.
That's pretty good. Yeah, I remember that, but I wasn't there until the summer of 81. But I mean, I used to go down to his house regularly to borrow. He had this gigantic collection of live tapes from bands from all over the world, and he had this one tape labeled Bauhaus Tut Chicago. So I grabbed that, copied it, brought it back. You know, I walk into his house, and these two guys are on this bed in the living room. One of them's on the, you know, beating drums, you know, on the linen, and it was Husker Du. And what? It's like only at Jello. And then, like, I live right across the street from Klaus Fluoride, and Klaus Fluoride engineered the original Juvenile Justice recordings. So, you know, I was, you know, you couldn't walk around from one side of San Francisco to the other without running into about 20 like you know, well known people, and it's like. I mean, and I was friends with a lot of them, and it was just really cool. It was like, and I came from San Diego, where the musician, you know, it was just like there was a buzz. There was always a buzz, and
sure.
And you know, I was from the time I moved there to the time I could walk in to the MAB, the Mabuhay, and like the owner Ness. You know, he loved me. He let me go in, buy me drinks, as long as I ran sound for one band that night. I mean, because he knew I was better than his regular sound man. But even that sound man, he knew I wasn't, you know, stepping on his toes, and because he knew I respected him. So, you know, it was just fun, you know, because that allowed him to go out and get a drink, and then he'd come back and take over again. But and he would let me plug my Marantz into the sound system, and I got some great live shows from there. You know, I used to do that at the On Broadway too, which was right up above, as a matter of fact. Gregory Corso, that was the name of the other beat poet. I mean, because I swear to God, like on one side there's Allen Ginsberg. I mean, like it's like. The guy who was in Chow Manhattan, you know, and you know, you know, like I think he's running around naked in Chow Manhattan with what was that chick? You know, the chick who was in there, you know, like the Edie Sedgwick. And on the other side is Gregory Corso, and like they're both, you know, just reciting random things from their works, and it was great. But like whenever Corso said, you know, people would boo, you know, like get a lube job, you know, they were off on the guy's like sexuality. But after that, there was a band called the Job, like headed by a friend of mine, Mark Olmsted. It was a very good songwriter. But you know, like they played the music while Ginsberg recited the complete of The Howl, you know, like his most famous poem. And like they, I had it on recording. I don't have a copy of it. I gave it to them, and I didn't make a copy for myself. And then, you know, like he stands off the stage and he lets them play for like, you know, another 20, 30 minutes. And you know, it was just like, you know, it was like there was so many cool things like that. I mean, that was poetry. That was supposed to be about poetry that night.
Right.
And then the music. So anyways, anything else you want to know?
Well, you know, a lot of the punkers downstairs at the Café de Grand used to do that too. They would do like spoken word, and you know, Henry Rollins went in and recorded a whole album where he was reciting his poems, his limericks.
You're right.
One that really stands out in my mind is the snail slowly slithering across the razor blade. That's so graphic in just a few words, you know. That's really something. But, you know, I've got some songs here of Johnny V's. And,
well, this is from our last practice, actually. And I just got a new amp set up, and I had never played it. So you guys get to hear it right now.
There you go. And here it is. And there's three songs back to back. The first one is
Kids from Nowhere.
Kids from Nowhere. And the second one is
Pissed Youth Riot.
Okay, and then Police Protection is last.
Yep.
Right? All right, here we go.
That's it. We'll be right back.
session. That's really nice recording you got there of just a simple practice. It's great, Johnny.
Yeah, well, you want to know how I did that?
How?
Well, you're going to hear it anyway. I've got two iPhones. I have a program, an app called... Hey, no, darling, put your foot, put your jam in the LA. Fuck off, bitch, go jump in the day. Hey, no, go for a nice scope. Jump in the country, time will go. Fuck off, bitch, go jump in the day. Hey, little hunk, fuck a little twat. Don't just hunt or clean that butt. Fuck off, bitch, go jump in the day. Fuck off, bitch.
My fingers slipped on the soundboard. Sorry about that. Didn't mean to cut you off.
Well, I used two iPhones, and then I just mixed the tracks together in Pro Tools. That's all. Nothing extravagant.
But it sounds really good. Yeah, it came out great.
Pretty good microphones on these things, actually.
Yeah, I'm impressed.
You got anything else, or?
Oh, how about No Sex? This is off your new album on Recovery.
No change, no morals, no justice, no malice. Hypocrite, girl, it's the same. Like a set of rules, it's all the same. No straight edge, no morals. No justice, no malice. Stand up, you're all belief. Don't be a domino, fall on your face.
Got a wild guitar solo in there in 56 seconds.
Song is called No SXE, as in No Straight Edge. So.
it was abbreviated on the file sent to me, and I titled it No Sex. It's been released that way. Well, I can always fix it, but... earlier you were talking about one of the first songs you wrote, Rumors of War. I've got that one. Would you like me to play it for everybody?
Sure.
All right, here we go with Rumors of War. I really like this. And you know, it shows how articulate Cliff Cunningham's voice is. He really puts it out there.
About the fighting, you always see it on TV, you read the comments in the papers, a fascist military, will it be long before it hits us, I hear a knocking on the doors, you say that it will not affect
your most recent practice, which sounds really killer, and one of your very first songs ever written, Rumors of War.
And it's still relevant today.
Yes, it
anyway,
is.
Anyway, you got anything from any of the bands we were talking about earlier, like the early San Diego bands? Well, I guess you already have it queued up, but...
All I have is on the board right now from San Diego would be Flower Leopards, but they weren't always from San Diego. They were there for a short time hanging out with Mark Rude. I think they roomed together or something, but...
Oh.
Yes. Well, you know, so you've been really around the punk scene from the beginning. You know, you're one of the pioneers of punk rock who survived. I mean, 39 years just with Social Spit, and then all of your other bands that you've been with is just amazing. You know, and. You've seen the San Francisco scene. It was really good because when the Hollywood scene became stagnant, everybody went up to San Francisco and it really was kicking up there and it was great.
My house was actually a way station for a lot of people from San Diego or from LA. Like they would come and stay with me for a week, and then they'd find their own places and get a job, and then they were up there. You know, it's like, lots of. You know, I remember when Battalion of Saints came up to play the Eastern Front. We hosted all of their girlfriends at my house, and then friends like Dane Conover from the Puppies came and stayed. I mean, and he was insisting that he was gonna sleep in his VW van. I'm all, no way, dude. You know, you're not gonna freeze your ass off when you
right.
can. And then I forced him to sleep in my living room, and he enjoyed not freezing.
Good.
But, it was great to see like there's people coming up constantly. Mostly just like friends, but you know sometimes the musicians and stuff like. One time, Giza X came in with a friend of ours, and I just jabbed for a while, and then he walks out, and this joint falls out of his pocket. So me and my girlfriend, we smoked it, and it wasn't what it appeared to be. It was like something like 100 times stronger than, and we were going crazy. We were bouncing off the walls.
Oh, my. Maybe it was laced with angel dust or something.
No, it was like, it was, you know, probably just really strong, but it wasn't what I expected, that's for sure. Because we had this roommate, Mark Voodoo, who would take LSD all the time, and he liked to put up these little string spider webs up in the corners. And like, you know, he wove himself into one day while he was tripping. So, yep.
Interesting.
There was plenty of fun things happened. Like, you know, I lived right on Castro, you know, like at the top of the hill. So that was a wonderful place to live. We had to move after that, and we lived on Langton, over by the red brick wall, which was like an underground like place, and you could hear the sounds like the screaming and stuff like all the way down the street.
Wow.
You know, it was around the corner from like Hamburger Mary's kind of, but then like finally like I lived up near the Hate, which was I would walk up and down Hate Street, and you would see this, there was this one apartment at the end of the street, and you'd see this big blob of black hair and people underneath like talking to it. I'm all, what the hell is that? So I get closer, and it's Susie, you know. I'm all, what the hell? And like, I get up there and it's Jimmy from Crucifix, you know. And he was with this friend of mine from down here, Monique. You know, she had green hair back then, but you know, like, and they're just, you know, having this discussion with, you know, and she's got her head out the window. You know, it's like, oh, I do
right,
this all
and,
the time. Apparently,
yeah.
She lived there. Like when that, she liked living there, so she would stay there as often as possible.
Well, those little Victorian style apartments are really cute, and they're just lined up one right after the other, and they all have those upstairs windows. So yeah, I can picture that. That sounds really cool.
It was wonderful. I mean, like, well, the I-beam was on the other side of the street, and for a while I would pick up you know, artists from the airport and bring them up to the Red Victorian, which was across the street. And you know, like my clients were like Blixa from Einstürzine Neubauten, and he was an interesting fellow, and the guitar player from Bauhaus, because like Tones on Tail played twice, so I drove him around twice, and that was a lot of fun. I miss being able to do that. But but you know what, I've got a rehearsal coming up in about an hour, but you know,
well,
like, do you need me for anything else?
Well,
I mean, this has been a lot of fun.
I know it has been fun, and I really enjoy your sharing of you know, the San Francisco scene back in the day. I was in between there. I lived in San Francisco in '74. Market,
wow.
A corner of Market and Powell, and I took a cab
to
work.
You probably got to see the Grateful Dead play right at the Hay Street Fair.
I didn't have time. I was working at National Photography, and
all I could do
is grab a cab to go to work every day, and then one day at Jack in the Box, we were eating after work, and there was a big riot outside. It's like, egads, you know, you could hear gunshots going off, and it's like,
wow.
Yeah, I feel at home from L.A. up here. But and then I moved back to L.A. and then started working in Hollywood in the punk scene there. So I missed the San Francisco punk scene, and I do know that one of our dear friends, my dear friends too, Carlos Guitaros, who played Monday Night Blues at the Café du Grand with Top Jimmy and the Rhythm Pigs, he went up there to the San Francisco scene and did pretty well there too, you know. But I missed it, and I don't want to keep you longer than you need to be. So it was great having you on, Johnny, and thank you for sharing with us your experiences in the early days of punk rock. And social spin.
You know, it's like San Diego, you know, like there, I mean, it's like you had to, you know, there were a couple of houses that were, there was the Mod House where Gary Heffern lived. And then there was the Boys Club, which was up on Armstrong Street. And then that were all like friends of mine when I was in Color TV, Alan Brown, Peter Verbuge, a bunch of other, you know, they used to have parties there all, and Peter had this amazing record collection. So the only things to do really in San Diego were like, you know, like underground events, like, because there really, well, I mean, at the beginning, there really wasn't any place for bands to play, so we would congregate at one place or another. But you know, by the time I got back from San Francisco, there were a couple of large venues. You know, there was, there was like a couple of big halls, Carpenter's Hall. There was a Wabash Hall, and there was this big roller rink on the corner of University. You know, and then the North Park Lions Club was still there for moderate size, because I remember a couple of times, like the Sea Hags, you know, you drove up and drove down in a van, and I got to talk to them for a while. And Paul Ratt was driving, you know, he was a manager from San Francisco that used to do No Alternative and bands like that. But you know, basically, you know, like in the, so, in, like in the mid '80s, it was a little bit better. And it's like, so some of the shows we got to play after we got going again were like in really big halls, you know, and there was lots of people, lots of chairs being smashed over our bass player's head.
Uh-oh.
You know, lots of,
that's not good.
Lots of, I think it's just like out of the blue. I mean, he's like standing there, like, you know, he was videotaping, like he had a handy cam. Somebody came up behind, whap, you know, hit him over the head. But I mean, it's like trouble just, like, you know, our first show, one of our first shows at the Saigon Palace, you know, he pulls up, there's this guy, Jay Bogart, who used to bother a couple of friends of ours, Alicia, you know, and like, you know, like Jay goes into the bathroom and like did something to him there to make him not bother us for about a week. Only lasted a week though. He started, you know, he would throw rocks through Cliff's car, you know, car window. You know, it was real. I mean, but you know, like there's a sad story that goes along with that, because it, in one day, or like within a couple of days, we lose him. But then we also lose this guy named Chris Jarhead, who was like a very talented musician, very nice guy, excellent musician. I mean, he played accordion, played saxophone. You know, he was a member of the original Phono, Friends of No One, with Mark Rood. And I remember seeing
who's
him
also
at a
we've
party.
Lost, rest in peace.
Yeah.
But,
in 1979 or so, or like 19, I don't know, like I had just come back from being on tour, you know, when I played 500 shows in 1 year with that religious outfit.
That's amazing, 500 shows in 1 year, and wow. Well, anyway, we're out of time, and you got a practice to get to, so I want to thank you for coming on. And
yeah, I just wanted to get a couple more things in, sorry.
No, go ahead,
all right,
go ahead.
Well, thanks. No, I already said them. Thanks a lot.
All right.
It's been cool.
All right. Have
cool.
a good time. And don't forget to party or go home.
Uh-huh.